It was a beautiful view. There was no doubt about that. From up here, we could see the Marin headlands ahead of us. To our left, the open ocean extended as far as I could see. To our right was San Francisco Bay and the city laid out at its feet. Even farther to our right extended the Bay Bridge, which led back to Berkeley and to Lodi. So different from the Golden Gate Bridge, the Bay Bridge gleamed silver and was built solely for functionality. But the Golden Gate Bridge was built for beauty. Even while I saw its splendor, I couldn't help but notice the telephones posted along the bridge that connected directly to counselors standing by to dissuade people from jumping. I remembered the chilling article I'd read years earlier that called the bridge a suicide magnet and revealed it had more suicides than any other bridge in the world. There had been nearly 30 that year, possibly more if you factored in the bodies that were never found. I forced myself to pull away from these grim and morbid thoughts. I looked instead at the sun gleaming in my daughter's hair, at my proud and patient husband, and at the undeniable glimmer of possibility that seemed to sparkle from this bridge overlooking so much magnificence. I would focus on that. I would choose to see that. Lodi. Francie arrived home a little after 4. She looked windswept and flushed, her hair a wild mane around her face, her nose and forehead tinged pink from the sun. She flopped down on the couch beside me, moving aside the stack of books and magazines. She glanced around the room. It looked as it had when she'd left that morning. "Where's Mia?" she asked. "Sally just went to get her. They should be back soon," I said. "What did you guys do today?" Francie looked tired but happy. "Oh, we walked along the Golden Gate Bridge. And then we drove through Golden Gate Park and the Presidio. God, I'd forgotten how beautiful it all is. Mark wants to take the girls back to the park to go to the Japanese Tea Garden. He bought them San Francisco sweatshirts, which I'm sure they'll be wearing till we get home. Did you have fun?" "Yeah, I did," she said, wrinkling her nose as if this surprised her. They went back to the hotel. I think he's going to take them to a movie tonight. "What about you? What did you do today?" "Not much," I said. "Did you call about work?" I nodded. I'd had a short conversation with the head of the English department, telling her that I would be with my sister in Boston while I recovered from the accident. My TAs would take over my classes for the next 6 weeks, and I'd resume teaching after I returned. She directed me to the human resources department to figure out disability for the time I was away. "And everything's okay?" Francie asked. "Yep." Francie nodded, reluctantly relaxing on the couch. "I'm glad you decided to come home with us," she said after a moment. "Yeah." I picked at a stray piece of thread on the couch. "Are you sure you're okay with it? I was surprised when Mark said you'd agreed." She watched me intently, scanning my face for signs of lies or omission. "Well, I can't say I'm thrilled about it, but it looks like the only option." "The girls are so excited to have you guys coming home with us. It will be like when we were roommates." I stared at her for a moment, trying to gauge if there was any sense of sarcasm in what she said. The last time we were roommates, Francie had force-fed me drugs. The last time we were roommates, Francie had counted the pills in the medicine cabinet and manipulated Wit into being part of her martyrdom. Could she seriously romanticize those days? "If I remember correctly, we didn't have the easiest time being roommates," I said carefully. "I know, but that wasn't all there was," Francie said. Remember Monday movie night? And the months when you were obsessed with Indian cooking? You made those elaborate feasts for us every night? I think we both started to smell like curry. I smiled, nodding. And the time you wanted me to ask out that guy from the coffee shop? Francie continued. Yeah, I remember. You were too scared to ask him yourself, so I dressed up like you and did it for you. It had felt odd to pretend to be Francie. I felt naked. Without the armor of clothes or makeup, there was so little to hide behind. I'd even had to adjust my smile, from my own loud and over-enthusiastic grin to Francie's softer, more reserved smile. I'm just saying we do have fun together. We can still have fun together. She reached out for my hand on the couch. I let her hold it loosely in her lap. If you say so, I said noncommittally, but I didn't pull away. Francie. On Thursday, I helped Lottie pack. When I brought Mia to daycare that morning, I told the teachers that she wouldn't be coming for the next 6 weeks. I can't hold her spot for 6 weeks, the lead teacher said. We have a waiting list. I most likely won't have room for Mia when Charlotte gets back. But what is she supposed to do? I asked her. The teacher made a face in sympathy. The only way I can guarantee a spot is if Charlotte continues to pay for the next 6 weeks. I'm sorry. How much is it? I asked, struggling in my purse for my checkbook. I wrote out a check for an exorbitant amount of money and handed it to the woman. She'll be back in 6 weeks. Please don't give me a spot up without talking to me first. I wrote my phone number down on a piece of paper and gave that to the woman as well. In the car on the way back to Lottie's, I made a mental list of the things we would need to do to get ready. Anna and Autumn's cribs were somewhere in the attic. We could pull one of them out and set it up in the study upstairs. There were the girls' old baby clothes up there, too, if they ended up staying longer, but I didn't want to think about that yet. It would be hard to let Mia go after 6 weeks. I could see that already. In the week that I'd been here, I had fallen in love with her a little bit, surprised by how easily I remembered how to care for an infant. When Anna and Autumn were Mia's age, I'd been so overwhelmed with what was required to take care of the two of them together. Mark returned to work after only 2 weeks, and I was left on my own with the girls. It didn't take much to conjure up the exhaustion and fear of that first year of motherhood. But somehow with Mia, it was different. It was just her, which obviously made it easier. But it was more than that. I was different. More confident, more at ease, calmer. I wondered if that was because she was not my child, or because I had changed somehow. Back at Lottie's house, I pulled out the large suitcase from under her bed, and we began to make piles. It quickly became clear that we would need another suitcase, and I pulled out a second one. "Babies sure do need a lot of stuff," Lottie said once we'd filled the second case. "She'll need a diaper bag for the plane, too," I said. Lottie nodded, sitting on the bed. She was perspiring lightly, her face flushed. "Are you feeling okay?" "I'm fine, just a little tired." She rubbed her hand against her eyes. "Do you want anything? Something to eat or drink?" "I'm not hungry." She stared into the suitcase at the brightly colored stacks of Mia's clothing that I'd neatly packed. Though she was looking at the clothes, her eyes seemed unfocused, as if she didn't actually see them. "Do you want me to get you one of the pain pills?" I asked. She shook her head without looking up. "No, that's okay." "Lottie, are you all right?" I swallowed, unable to push the rest of the sentence back down. "You're still taking your other medication, right?" "Francie," she said sharply, holding up a hand like a traffic guard. I'm sorry. I'm just making sure you're okay. I'm fine. I'm just tired, she snapped. Okay. I returned to the packing. Lottie stayed where she was. Her shoulders turned slightly away from me, though she began to help fold the clothes as best she could with only one arm. Are you going to tell Whit you're leaving? I asked after a few minutes. She shook her head. It's over. For good, this time. Her face was hard, her mouth a straight line. I'm sorry. I know you were hoping he'd come around. Deep down, I think I knew he wouldn't change his mind. She let out a harsh laugh. He's like me that way. Stubborn. I was quiet, and she continued. It's funny. There's really no one to tell that I'll be gone. She looked a little dazed and surprised by this. But you've always had tons of friends. I'm sure there are people for you to tell. Oh, I have friends. I have people I go out to dinner with, and people to go to the movies with, and out for drinks. She gestured vaguely with her hand. They're fun to talk to and go out with, but they're not, she grasped for the word, confidants. She grimaced at the term. I'm not really close to any of them, just you and Whit. Would you ever think about staying in Boston? It wasn't what I wanted, was it? The idea of having Lottie close by again was both terrifying and thrilling. Oh, Francie, I don't know, she said, shaking her head. My life is here. My work is here. She gave a small smile that looked like it took effort. But never say never, right? We turned back to the suitcases, both of them fully packed now. I lifted them from the bed and placed them on the floor by the closet, still open in case we needed to add anything later. I'm going to take a nap, Lottie said, hoisting her leg up onto the bed. She pulled back the covers and lay back down, her features suddenly overcome by exhaustion. Are you sure you're okay? I asked again, hovering in the doorway. I realized that she hadn't actually answered my question about the medication, only insisted that she was fine. Lottie had already closed her eyes, and she didn't open them when she answered. Francie, just try to relax. Really, you don't have to worry so much. But I do, I thought to myself. I closed the door lightly behind me. Lottie. It had only been a day, and my mind was heavy. My head swirling with a milky black mud that seeped into my nose and eyes and ears. It was the middle of the night, and I couldn't sleep. Though I'd wanted nothing more than sleep for most of the day, scaring Francie, scaring myself. Already? I thought. Are we here again so fast? I stood in the bathroom that night, the magic bottle of pills in my hand. Just take one and you'll begin to feel better, I instructed myself in the same voice I knew Francie would have used. I had a foggy memory from years earlier of Francie and Whit wrestling me to the bed, pinning my arms and legs down, shoving the medication into my mouth. Francie pinching my nose, cutting off my air supply until I had no choice but to swallow. If I closed my eyes, I could still feel the lump in the back of my throat from the pill going down. That was the night that Francie and Whit entered into a twisted pact that I knew, ultimately had my best interest at heart. But what was the price of better? I tucked the bottle into the pocket of my plaid pajama pants and made my way slowly into Mia's bedroom, trying to walk as quietly as possible in the heavy plastic boot. The bottle clicked against my thigh, a reminder. As soon as I entered Mia's bedroom, I was overcome by the smells I'd come to associate with her. Lotion, powder, milk, something sweet. A calmness in the terror of the night. She'd learned how to roll over just a few weeks earlier, and she slept more soundly now on her tummy, her small back rising and falling, her head a mess of black curls against the pink sheets. I settled myself into the rocking chair and leaned forward to watch her through the slats of the crib. Until the accident, she had slept with me at night, using her crib only for naps. Yet she seemed to sleep more soundly in her own room, her own bed, alone. I slipped my hand into my pocket, rubbed my thumb against the smooth plastic of the bottle. I was sliding. I felt the black working to get its slippery claws on my mind, its liquid presence ready to fill my limbs and head and mouth with its mud. But here and now, with Mia, I also felt the heat of my love for her. The pain of it, more fiercely than I had just the day before. Wasn't this truly who I was? When stripped of everything else? Without the drugs running through my blood, my heart was tender in a way it couldn't be while medicated. It was open and strong and fierce. And yes, raw, too. So often I wondered if I'd passed this sleeping beast down to Mia. Would her mind turn in on itself someday? Would I be here to see it? It didn't make sense that just a few 100 milligrams of some chemical mixed in a lab should hold the key to my undoing. I was more than that. I was more than an illness. A label, a list of symptoms. I was more than a problem to be managed. In a few days, I'd rise above the black, and I would hold the power of the white in the palm of my hand. I'd have the strength that people dream of, that people read self-help books to discover and run on treadmills to develop. I would soar above the pain that ran squalid on the earth. And I'd hold Mia close to my heart. I was stronger than the disease. I knew that now. I just needed to convince Francie. I rose from the rocking chair, my fingers lingering on Mia's warm scalp. "Good night, sweet girl," I whispered. I placed the bottle of pills in the diaper pail on my way out. Francie. I awoke early Friday morning. I lay in bed and stared at the cracks and watermarks on Lottie's ceiling, remembering the story of the character who believed a woman was trapped in her walls. Lottie had been so confident in her understanding of the story, so certain of its outcome. I was the one who wanted to believe in another ending. Lottie lay beside me, sleeping heavily in the early morning light. She'd slept restlessly, tossing and turning, struggling to get comfortable. I'd heard her in the bathroom and then checking on Mia. When I asked her if she was okay, she murmured that she'd slept too much during the afternoon and then rolled away from me. But she slept now, peacefully, deeply, her mouth parted slightly, eyes flickering rapidly beneath the lids. I forced myself to lie in bed beside her until I heard Mia call, and then I rose quietly and went to change and feed her. When Lottie finally emerged from the bedroom, it was after 9. "Morning," Lottie murmured, scratching her hair absently. "There's coffee in the kitchen," I told her. "I was going to take Mia to daycare in a few minutes." "Okay." Her face was slightly puffy, her skin pale. She fixed herself a cup of coffee and came to sit beside us, leaning over to give Mia a light kiss on the cheek. "What are you doing today?" "Mark wants to take the girls back to Golden Gate Park," I hesitated. "Unless you want me to stay here." She sipped the coffee. "No, I'll be fine." I waited just a beat before I offered, "You can come with us if you want." She shook her head, making a face. "Nah, I've been tons of times. I'll just hang out here." "Are you sure?" I asked, generous now that she'd declined. "I'm sure." She scooted closer to us on the couch, rested her cup of coffee on the table. "Can I feed her?" "Of course." I helped place pillows both underneath and on top of her arm in the cast, and we rested Mia on her carefully. Lottie looked serene, her face washed in a kind of peace that hadn't been there in previous days. I felt a hopeful lightening of my chest as I watched them together. I forced myself to stay quiet, to not ask questions, to not make conversation, to just sit silently beside them. The moment was interrupted by the doorbell, and suddenly Mark and the girls were upon us, filling the room with noise and laughter and chattering. Lottie looked a little stunned at the arrival of my family in her house, both filling it up and emptying it at the same time.
"Are you ready to go?" Mark asked me.
"In a minute," I said. "I need to pack some things for Mia for daycare."
"I thought we could take her with us," he said.
"Really? Won't it be hard to have her along?" I asked.
"She'll sleep in her stroller in the car seat," Mark said confidently. "The girls want to spend the day with her."
Anna and Autumn were crouched by Lottie's feet, leaning into her lap to watch Mia.
"Can she come?"
Anna asked Lottie. "She needs to be changed," Lottie said, avoiding the question as she placed the bottle back on the table. I lifted her from Lottie's arm.
"I can do it," Mark said.
Lottie and I both looked at him, me in surprise, Lottie with skepticism.
"What?" "I know how to change a diaper. It may have been a few years, but I changed quite a few diapers in my day."
It was true. When the girls were babies, Mark took over every night when he got home from work. I'd often watch him in awe, tired after a long day's work, but still so at ease with the care that the girls needed. He'd prop the two of them in the crook of his arm and then hold their bottles side by side in his hand. When they needed changing, if Mark was home, he was the one to carry them ceremoniously up the stairs. Mark bent down and lifted Mia into his arms.
"Come on, little girl, let's get you cleaned up," he murmured into her ear as he carried her out of the room, Autumn trailing him.
"Can't she come?"
Anna asked again, sitting beside Lottie on the couch. Lottie reached out a hand and smoothed back a strand of hair that had fallen into Anna's face.
"I guess so. If your mom wants to take her, it's not really up to me."
I felt a pang of guilt, though I wasn't really sure for what. For inviting Lottie and her daughter into our home while she recuperated? For flying out here to take care of them both? No. It was for the tug of war that Lottie thought we were playing with Mia. But weren't we? It wasn't only in her head, and we both knew it, try as we might to pretend otherwise. "I can bring her to daycare if you'd prefer," I said to Lottie. Her face looked flat, empty, the peaceful calm lost in the chaos of the last few minutes. "Or," I paused, leaning forward, trying to get her to look at me. She was still focusing on Anna, her hand still in Anna's hair. Uncharacteristically, Anna remained still, letting Lottie fuss over her for a moment. "Or I could just stay here with you and Mia, and Mark can take the girls to the park." Lottie didn't answer me.
"You have a scar," she said to Anna instead.
Lottie's hand cupped Anna's cheek and hair, but she was staring at the white puckered line just below Anna's eyebrow atop the bone of her eye socket.
"She has a scar," Lottie repeated, but this time to me,
finally turning to meet my eyes before looking back at Anna's face. It was thin, but nearly 2 inches long.
I was surprised that Lottie hadn't noticed it before, but maybe she hadn't been looking. I nodded, unable to say more. Part of me wanted to brush it off as inconsequential, but part of me wanted to root her to this spot, to force her to see what she had done. The feeling was quickly replaced again with the desire to absolve her, but I knew that would have been impossible. Anna hadn't said a word, but she watched us both with wide and anxious eyes. "It's not too bad," I finally said. Lottie shook her head, her eyes suddenly filled with tears.
"Beautiful girl,"
she whispered as tears began to slide down her face. Anna remained rigid, afraid to move out of Lottie's hold, but her eyes found mine.
"Mommy,"
she said, her voice full of confusion and fear. I reached for my daughter, pulling her toward me and away from my sister, again away from my sister, but this time more gently.
"It's okay, honey,"
I assured Anna as I wrapped a protective arm around her thin frame.
"Why is Aunt Lottie crying?"
she whispered, though Lottie was sitting so close that their knees were touching.
"She's just a little sad, but she'll be okay,"
I told Anna, gathering her hair.
"Should we do French braids today?"
I asked, to change the subject, to give her some small gift for putting up with the strange moment she'd just had with her aunt. Anna pulled closer to me and nodded, but I watched as she reached out a tentative hand.
"Will you have a scar too?"
Anna asked, her fingers resting on the track of stitches above Lottie's ear. Lottie ran her forefinger over the thick black line of thread. She managed a half-smile.
"I guess I probably will."
"It's not so bad," Anna said authoritatively. "It's how everyone will tell you and Mommy apart."
She pulled her hand back and turned to face me.
"So can Mia come with us?"
she asked again, this time the impatience creeping into her voice. I looked from Anna to Lottie, my eyes resting on the scars, new and old, that I'd imagined to grow accustomed to in the days, weeks, and months.
"She can come."
Anna let out a whoop and took off to find her sister. "Is that okay?" I asked Lottie, though we had both long grown tired of my solicitousness.
"It's fine," Lottie said, sounding irritated.
"Just bring some bottles with you. And don't forget the diaper bag." I forced myself not to roll my eyes, not to make a snappy comment. "I'll bring everything she needs," was all I said. I knew the trip was a bad idea as soon as we took the wrong exit. Mark accidentally got off at the exit for Fisherman's Wharf, which meant we had to navigate the traffic of the touristy area as well as downtown. I'd been second-guessing myself from the moment we pulled away from Lottie's house. Mia had been fussing in the back seat off and on since we'd gotten on the road. She'd drift off to sleep, and then someone in the car would make a loud noise, Mark cursing as we missed the exit, me yelling as he nearly ran over a jaywalking pedestrian, the girls squealing over the roller coaster-like hills of Pacific Heights, and she'd be awake again, whimpering or squalling in her seat. I focused on the road and clenched and unclenched my fists, trying not to let my frustration and panic spill over into the car. The traffic downtown was stop and go. We'd have a minute at a red light, followed by the rush of several lanes of traffic for a few blocks, only to sit at a red light again. Suddenly, the afternoon seemed a foolish idea. What had Mark been thinking? Taking Mia and the rest of the family for an afternoon in the city the day before we'd all be boarding a plane to go back to Boston. I'd gotten caught up in his enthusiasm when I should have been back at Lottie's house, taking care of my sister and doing last-minute packing. As we inched down Market Street, I was overwhelmed by the numbers of homeless people slumped on curbs or slowly meandering down the sidewalks amidst the office workers who obviously rushed past, clutching cups of coffee. I knew that many, if not most, of these men and women were mentally ill. Some of them likely had the same chemical imbalance as my sister and were unable or unwilling to accept help. I turned around to see if Anna and Autumn had noticed the multitudes of weary and downtrodden just outside their window, but they were focusing intently on the sticker books that Mark had bought them for the airplane. "I'm going to call Lottie to make sure everything is okay," I told Mark as I dug around in my purse for my phone. "What the hell is that?" he asked, waving his hand as a bicyclist darted in front of him, ignoring the narrow bike lane that ran alongside the traffic. "No wonder your sister was hit by a car if she was riding anything like that, moron." I didn't answer and dialed Lottie's home number. "Hi," I said when she answered. "Hi. Are you guys okay? Is Mia okay?" she asked. "Yeah, everyone's fine. I was just worried about you. Are you all right?" In the back seat, Mia whined again, and I fumbled in the diaper bag for a bottle. "Honey, can you give this to her?" I handed the bottle to Anna. "Sorry," I said, turning back to the phone. "Are you all right? I feel bad that we left you all alone." "I'm fine, Francie. Bored and stir-crazy, but I'm fine." "Okay. I trailed off, unsure how to finish. "I had a weird moment of panic. I wanted to make sure you were okay." "I'm fine." Her voice was small and far away. "Francie?" "Yeah?" "I'm so sorry about Anna. The scar. What happened last year when you were here. I'm really sorry about everything." "I know you are, sweetie. So am I. It's over now, though. It's in the past." I turned around to see that Anna was only holding the bottle halfway up so that Mia was sucking down air bubbles. "Anna, you have to lift the bottle all the way up. She can't get the milk that way." When I turned around, Mark was running through a yellow light just as it turned red. About 15 pedestrians on either side of the street had already begun to cross. "Mark, be careful," I hissed. He was hunched forward over the steering wheel as if he were a race car driver. "Sorry, it's a little chaotic in here," I said to Lottie. "Mark took the wrong exit."
"You didn't tell me which exit I was supposed to take," Mark argued. "You could have given me a little warning."
I waved him away and pressed the phone closer to my ear. "We'll be home soon," I told Lottie. "We'll have dinner together tonight. We can talk more then, okay?" "Sure," Lottie said. And then she was gone. Lottie. How had I not seen the scar? It was so clear against Anna's skin. Such a bright white, so close to her eye, so there. How had I kept myself from noticing it until today? The house was quiet now that everyone had left. The black was coiled around my spine, waiting, my midnight strength suddenly gone in the yellow light of day. In the white of Anna's scar, I forced myself to breathe deeply, to rise above the pain that radiated from my arm, from my hollowed-out heart, from the sleeping darkness. I tried to watch TV. I tried to read. Francie called to check on me, and I tried to apologize for everything, but she was distracted and distant, her heart too full of others. I made my way to the hallway and threw open the front door. Outside, the air was sweet and unseasonably warm for February. There was something so hopeful in this, something so very necessary to my spirit that I wanted nothing more than to spend the day outside. But doing what? I couldn't walk, couldn't bike, I couldn't even sit on a park bench very comfortably. Could I drive? The doctor had said it wasn't safe to drive, not till both casts were off. But in my car, I could roll down the windows, feel the fresh air against my skin, washing away the pallor of sadness and foreboding that seemed to coat everything. I wasn't even certain if I'd be able to maneuver the wheel and pedals, but I went back inside to get ready, my heart lifting slightly at the possibility of doing something, anything other than sitting around the house all day long, waiting for Francie and Mark to take me back to Boston with them like a cheap souvenir they'd picked up on their trip. In my bedroom, I managed to take off the pajama pants and replace them with a pair of shapeless black linen pants. I found my purse, wallet, and keys and went out to the car. I unlocked the driver's side door and backed my body in, first letting my butt land on the seat and then slowly swiveling to face forward, using my good arm to help lift my leg inside the car. I was fumbling with the keys when I saw Sally making her way down her front steps, holding hands with a man I'd never seen before. They were smiling at each other and talking, their bodies in contact at all times in the way of new lovers. When Sally saw me in the car, I watched her features cloud with concern. "Shit," I muttered under my breath as Sally made her way toward the car. I managed to get my other leg in and shut the door behind me, pretending I hadn't noticed them. Sally was knocking on the window only a minute later. I unrolled it and gave her what I hoped was a big smile.
"Hi, Charlotte."
Sally peered into the back seat to see if Mia was with me.
"What are you doing?"
"Oh, just going for a little drive," I said.
"Are you sure that's such a good idea?"
Sally asked. Behind her, I noticed the tall new boyfriend watching me with curiosity.
"I mean, I don't think you're really in any condition to drive."
She gave me an anxious smile. "I'll be fine. I usually only drive with one hand anyway," I joked. "Good thing I'm a lefty, huh?" I started the engine.
"Charlotte, really, if you need to go somewhere, I'd be happy to drive you. Or we could pick something up for you. If you need medicine or whatever."
She shifted uncomfortably beside the window. So Francie had told her. It made sense, of course. But why did I find myself angry at Francie? And why did I find myself more than a little ashamed to have Sally know my secret? "Who's your friend?" I asked, looking past Sally, ignoring her offer for help. Sally looked behind her as if she'd briefly forgotten about her new love. The man stepped forward and put a hand on Sally's back, leaning over her.
"I'm Liam," he said, reaching his hand through the open window.
I gave him the fingers of my left hand and we shook uncomfortably.
"I think Sally's probably right. It's not safe for you to drive like that."
I gently tested my right foot against the brake. I didn't have a lot of feeling through the plastic of the boot, but it didn't hurt, and I could use the amount of pressure I would need for both the gas and the brake. "You're sweet to be concerned, but I'm just fine," I told them, leaning forward to roll the window back up. "You kids have fun now," I said as my window closed. Sally tried to talk to me through the closed glass, but I'd already turned the radio on and was shifting the car into drive. They both stepped back, out of the way of the car, and I pulled out into the street. I wondered how long it would be before Sally called Francie. It took me a few minutes to get the hang of driving. I held the wheel with my left hand and was able to press on the pedals with my right foot. I'd already been on the road for several minutes before I realized that I was on the Bay Bridge heading into San Francisco. The traffic was surprisingly light. It was late morning, and rush hour had ended several hours earlier, but I gripped the wheel tightly, my heart beating too fast. I had pulled over to unroll the window once I was out of Sally's range, and the noise of the wind cutting through the car was loud, a jackhammer in my brain. But with only one hand, I couldn't manipulate the manual windows to roll it back up, so I forced myself to breathe deeply as the exits for San Francisco started to appear. I took the exit for Market Street and carefully made my way down the off-ramp and onto Folsom. I didn't go into San Francisco often.
I tended to only go when I had visitors in town or on a rare afternoon when Whit and I decided to go to the museum or to the park for a picnic. It was the East Bay's pretty sister, and though I preferred the funky hominess of Berkeley, San Francisco gleamed and sparkled in a way that my own city did not. But the area below Market Street was San Francisco's dirty little secret. The homeless and drug addicted pushed just out of sight of the tourists. I stopped at a red light and tried to force myself to breathe deeply, to allow my heart rate to return to normal. On my left, a man pushed a grocery cart, piled high with what would have been garbage to most people. Old clothes, newspapers, and tattered books. On the sidewalk to my right, a gaunt woman in a filthy t-shirt and jeans held a sign asking for change. Her blonde hair was matted with knots. I thought of the stories that Mother used to tell us about Louisa and Mirabella Strout. The ones where they would try to save the homeless with chocolate cakes and stacks of blankets. Looking back now, I realized the stories all possessed a desire to overcome the powerlessness that Mother must have felt in the face of her own sadness, which burrowed its way into her heart like a worm in an apple. It found its way in, but then couldn't find a way out. I watched the skinny blonde woman, and when she moved her cardboard sign, I realized with a start that though her arms were like sticks and her shoulders sharp, her belly was round and low, her hand resting protectively in the way I knew so well. A car beeped behind me, but I was paralyzed. The woman was sitting on a dirty blanket, and she looked up to see why the horns were blaring, her eyes meeting mine. I flicked on my hazard lights and put the car in park, reaching for my purse, barely noticing the sounds of other drivers honking at me, cursing as they swerved around me. I eased myself out of the car and walked unsteadily over to where the woman sat. As I got closer, I realized she was younger than she appeared, probably not yet 30. Her skin was deeply tanned, and dirt was visible in the cracks and lines of her face, but she would have been pretty if she were living another life. A book was open on her lap. "What are you reading?" I asked. She didn't question my presence here, my injuries, my double-parked car, likely recognizing someone else whose life was falling down around her. Instead, she held the book up. It was a history textbook, and she was turned to a section on the Mayans. "Is it interesting?" The woman shrugged. "It's okay," she said, and her voice was soft and young. I wanted to ask her so many things. How she had gotten here in the first place, what she'd once wanted in this life, if she was sad all the time or if she hoped for something better, what she was going to do once her baby was born, if she still believed in the future, if she had family or anyone who loved her. Somehow I felt certain she held some special knowledge, some secret understanding that she might be able to impart.
"You want it? I've got others."
The woman gestured to the shopping cart behind her. I felt my eyes fill at the generosity of the gesture, but I shook my head. "When are you due?" I asked instead.
"The end of May."
She leaned forward, conspiratorially.
"I hope it's a girl. I know I'm not supposed to care. I mean, all I really care about is having a healthy baby, but..."
She gave me a shy smile.
"I'd really love to have a little girl."
I nodded, my vision blurry with tears. The black was in my eyes, my ears tugging at my hair. I forced myself to smile. "You're carrying low. It looks like a girl," I told her. Her face lit up.
"You think?"
"Definitely."
I unsnapped my purse and dug out my wallet. I had $43 and some change, and I slipped the bills out and emptied the change into my palm, handing it all over to the woman. Here, for you. She thanked me, though she didn't seem surprised by the gesture. Perhaps by now used to both the kindness and indifferent cruelty of strangers.
"What's your name?"
she asked as I turned away. "Louisa. Louisa Strout," I told her.
"Thanks, Louisa,"
she called after me as I hobbled back to the car. I got back inside faster this time, the pain of my body seeming to leave me, to hover around me in the halo of black. As I pulled into traffic, I looked back at the woman. Her hand was resting on her belly, and she'd gone back to her book. "I am Louisa Strout," I thought, "and I am invisible." I climbed back in my car and kept driving. As my car flew down Fell Street, as I fought to steady my breathing while cars inched in on either side of me, as I nearly ran through several red lights and realized that I couldn't really feel my foot on the gas pedal, it was during all this that I grasped the magnitude of the mistakes I had made over the past few days. I clutched the wheel tightly as my car hurtled forward. All of it beyond my control now. The bottle of pills sitting at the bottom of a diaper pail or already on the way to a landfill. The black had arrived, unbidden as usual, and he had snaked his way into my heart and soul, leaving his filthy fingerprints on all that I held dear. As I soared down the four-lane road, I realized I had only one hope left. Francie. I spoke her name aloud as if I could summon her up, and likely somewhere in this sparkling city I had. I forced myself to focus, to remain calm, to recall where they had gone today. I remembered them talking of tea, of flowers, of Japan, and then I remembered they were going to Golden Gate Park. "Breathe, Charlotte, breathe," I ordered myself. But it was Mother's voice that I heard. I felt her cool hand on my brow, wiping away the sorrow and grief and sadness that seemed to live there always. I flew farther down the street, and the cement of downtown was slowly replaced by green, the towering trees of the panhandle growing thicker as I got closer to the park. The flat brick apartment buildings were gradually replaced by pastel-colored Victorians. I made a shaky, one-handed left turn, and then a right onto Fell, the street that led toward Golden Gate Park. I was beside the park, its eucalyptus trees on my right, and somewhere inside were Francie and Mia. Tears had started to slide down my cheeks, but I blinked them away because they obscured my vision. My head ached, my arm throbbed, and I heard the voice of the black as he pulled back my hair to whisper in my ear. "I told you so," he hissed, his voice scratchy and raw. "You're wrong," I pleaded as I turned onto 9th Avenue. Francie was near. I felt her waiting for me, guarding Mia. "Please," I whispered. Suddenly, I saw the signs for the Japanese tea garden, and for a moment, my chest filled with hope. Hope, the most vital and sacred of all emotions. My eyes scanned the road for Francie. I was sure she was looking for me as I was for her. Pedestrians, bikers, and inline skaters whirled past on both sides, and music drifted in the window, a chorus of bongo drums and guitars. Before I realized what had happened, I'd driven past the exit for the gardens and had turned onto the road leading to Park Presidio Boulevard. "No!" I cried, craning to look in my rearview mirror, but it was too late. I was in the green belly of the park, surrounded by the oppressive canopy of trees. Again, cars rushed by on both sides, and I hurtled forward on a narrow road that was nearly as busy as a highway, though it was swathed by the trees. My heart opened with longing and regret,
So certain was I that I'd left behind Mia and Francie. My life. My last chance. As the park receded behind me, I mustered up my strength and courage and tried to find my way back even as the road spit me out on the other side of the park. The cars were flying at 50 miles an hour, and I couldn't find an exit on either side. "Pull over," I ordered myself, but there was no place to go. I was in the middle of several lanes, and all of the cars were boxed in tightly. My body vibrated with pain, each beat of my heart a blood-surging pang. Thump my arm, thump my foot, thump my head, thump my heart and soul and very being. "You've missed your exit, Charlotte," the black cackled. "There's nowhere left to go." The car barreled ahead, and I realized that I was driving up the ramp toward the Golden Gate Bridge. The green was replaced with the blue of the sky and ocean. Something inside of me gave in. Let go. A sweet release. Like I'd been holding my breath underwater for a long time and could finally breathe. The beauty was astonishing, and I couldn't help it. I took my eyes from the road. The wide wires of the bridge were suspended in air, and as I sped north, the burnished red supports appeared to rise up like arms welcoming me home. Below me churned the cold, dark ocean, but above, the sun was bright, its yellow holding magic, the bridge promising good things to come. My heart raced, and I knew that Francie's did too, pounding in time with my own somewhere nearby in this lush city of green and gold, her beautiful and expanding family holding her safe in their orbit. I let my hand rise off the wheel, my eyes on sky instead of road. My heart burned for my daughter, knowing the unhealable pain that she would carry with her forever, just as I had. "Mother," I cried. "Mother, can you hear me?" "I'm here," came her answer, and her fingers reached for mine, carrying me up into the blue and gold sky. Below me, the crash of metal was deafening. Francie. It was nearly 11 by the time we arrived at the Japanese Tea Garden in Golden Gate Park. I strapped Mia's car seat into the stroller and ushered the girls from the car. I tried to let the disquiet fade away. As we began to walk, Mark let his hand linger at the small of my back, and we made our way to the entrance of the gardens. Once inside, I felt some of my anxiety dissipate. The gardens were beautiful, green and lush with brightly colored flowers. Orange koi circled lazily in green, lily-laden ponds, and the girls squatted by the ponds to watch the oversized goldfish. They climbed the small footbridge, and I took pictures of them holding hands at the top, the sun glinting off their long blonde braids. After we finished walking, we made our way into the open hut where tea was served. Mia had been sleeping soundly since I put her in the stroller, and the din of the tea room seemed to keep her asleep. We all ordered tea and Japanese pastries, and then Anna and Autumn went to wander around the garden some more while we waited for the food to arrive. "Stay on this side so I can see you," I told them as they made their way down the steps. I leaned forward and pulled the hood up on Mia's car seat and then turned back to Mark. He smiled at me, the blue of his fleece making his eyes bluer than usual.
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I just feel weird leaving Lottie at home all day." A waitress came bearing a tray of tiny ceramic teacups and a steaming turquoise teapot. Anna and Autumn crouched at the edge of one of the ponds, their fingers dipping through the surface of the water. I poured a cup of tea and took small sips. "Shit," I said suddenly, putting the cup down.
"What's wrong? Did you burn yourself?" Mark asked.
I leaned down and rummaged through the diaper bag and then checked my purse. No, I think I left my cell phone in the car. I pictured it in the small hutch between the seats where I'd left it after hanging up with Lottie.
So, you don't need it, Mark said, picking up his tea.
The cup looked tiny in his large hands. What if Lottie tries to call? I should go back to the car, I said, standing up.
Francie, we just got here. Will you relax? You talked to her less than an hour ago. She's fine.
Mark reached for my hand and tugged at me. I remained standing. I scanned the gardens until I found my children's blonde heads by a flowering purple plant.
I have my phone, Mark said. She can call me if she needs to get in touch with us.
Does she know your number? I asked. Mark sighed, loosening his grip on me.
I'm not sure.
He handed me the phone.
Call her. Give her my number.
I sat down and punched in the digits of Lottie's number. The phone rang and rang before going to voicemail.
She's not answering, I told Mark. She probably just doesn't recognize the number, he said.
He appraised me for a moment, then reached into his pocket for the keys to the car.
Go on. Go get your phone. I'll stay here with the girls.
I jogged the several blocks back to where we'd parked the car, and by the time I unlocked the door, I was out of breath. When I looked at the phone, there were two missed calls from a Berkeley number. I listened to the message that had been left. It was from Sally, explaining that she'd seen Lottie getting in her car and driving away. I hung up before Sally finished speaking and dialed Lottie's cell phone number. Again, it went straight to voicemail.
God damn it, Lottie, I cursed.
I called Sally back, only to get the same information as I'd heard on the message. I told her to call me if Lottie came home. I looked around the park wildly, not knowing where to go or what to do. Around me, people skated and biked and walked leisurely, holding hands or tending to children. The park was abuzz with a calm and festive spirit that countered every muscle in my body. I tried to breathe deeply, but instead found myself crouching beside the car, my face in my hands. It was as I cowered on the ground that I felt it. Lottie rushed through my body with the force of a wave, powerful and dangerous. She was inside me, and then she wasn't. Though I hadn't been aware of her presence, her absence was cold and pervasive. It filled my mouth and cheeks, all the way down to my toes, and I wondered how I was still breathing. I don't know how long I was there, inhaling the smell of grass and dirt, trying to quell the overwhelming sense of doom that had overtaken me. But when I opened my eyes, Mark was saying my name. He was there with Anna and Autumn, who watched me uneasily, and Mia was nestled against his chest.
She's gone,
I told him before I forced myself to rise. My legs were weak as I blinked into the luminous green and gold of the park and understood that nothing would ever be the same. Francie. January. It was the second day of the new year, and the snowstorm was just reaching its conclusion. Today was supposed to have been the first day back at school after the Christmas vacation, but it had been snowing since the early morning and school was canceled. An unexpected gift. An hour ago, the power went out, and though it was only mid-afternoon, we'd lit candles and spread blankets on the floor to play Candyland. I stood at the living room window, my fingers pressed against the cold glass as I watched the last flakes of snow pile up in the backyard. Nearly a foot had fallen. Lottie never liked the cold, had never understood my desire to move to the Northeast, but I looked forward to the giant blizzards that occurred every couple of years. Lottie didn't like the extremes of New England. The sweltering days of summer and then the sudden plunge into winter.
Perhaps her desire for the easy middle ground came from her own uncontrollable extremes. Several years earlier, my sister had visited over Christmas. It snowed on the afternoon of Christmas Eve. A giant, blustery storm, much like this one, and